the condensed matter review course. The name of the course is Many Body Entanglement and Tensor Network. This is going to be 3 weeks, as all the courses, but you may have been told already that the format is a bit different. So we'll have nine a.m. classes, lectures every day, and then there will be other lectures. What we've done, you probably have access to some schedule on the wiki, and there you can see that there are lectures called TH, Theory, and lectures called Julia. And so what we have is theory lectures, but also hands-on Julia lectures where, so the theory lectures will be here. In time room, the iJulia lectures will be in the Psi room, and they will be more interactive. We'll have the laptops and we'll work. You know, it will be a combination of instructions and you play around a little bit, and then we discuss things. Very good. So I thought I would start with the motivation for the course. So what I want to do in this course is give you an idea of how we go computationally about studying many-body problems, and specifically to introduce during the third week, we'll talk about some recent developments. Recent means in the last 10 years. As motivation, let's start with some motivation here. So let's consider a simple Hamiltonian on a d-dimensional lattice. So we're going to start with some spin system. And we're just going to go and imagine that we have quantum spins on a lattice. And we're going to write the Ising Hamiltonian. So sum over nearest neighbors. We're going to consider that we have n quantum spins. Where, let's see, let me define this sigma x is this matrix. These are polymatrices, sigma z. Okay? And so imagine that what we want to do is to study a problem that can be modeled. It's a physical system that can be modeled by a simple Hamiltonian where the degrees of freedom are quantum spin sitting on the vertices of a lattice, say a square lattice, and the interaction is given by Hamiltonian as simple as this, where we have some magnetic field acting on each individual spin, and then some interaction, nearest neighbor interaction between spins. Okay, so this is a very simple model. We use quantum mechanics, so standard rules. We understand the rules of the game. This is your Hamiltonian, and now you would like to understand how the system behaves. Okay, of particular interest would be to understand the properties of the ground state of the system. So what we're going to see is that we run into problems quite fast. So what's the Hilbert space for this system? Well, we just follow the rules of quantum mechanics. And what we have is that it's going to be the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces for each of the spins. And so we have the tensor product. And then what we have is that this Hilbert space here of the vector space attached to each spin is going to be just C2, so two complex vector space of dimension 2. And what we have is that if we look at the dimension of this Hilbert space of n spins, That's going to be equal to the dimension of one of those to the nth power, and that's going to be exponential in some constant a times n, exponential in the number of spins, okay? And that's going to be a big problem for us. For instance, in this case, this would be 2 to the n, okay? Let me see. So this is a typical situation we have when we try to study many-body systems. For instance, our task would be, and will be later on, to find the ground state. H, and that's some wave function psi such that it's an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian with the smallest possible energy. Okay, smallest eigenvalue. And so, you know, this is a problem that it's easy to pose. This is what we're trying to solve. And then let's make a couple of observations. First is that H is not really the Hamiltonian that we wanted. It's just already an approximation. So typically, this is what we are going to be calling a minimal model or minimal Hamiltonian, minimal model Hamiltonian. That is, it's a crude approximation. So it's an approximation to the degrees of freedom that we want. And also to the interactions. Okay? But the point is that we believe that maybe this Hamiltonian is good enough to capture the essence of what of the system that we are trying to describe. For instance, these spins could be pointing up or down. Well, maybe these are degrees of freedom of electrons that are essentially sitting on the wells, the bottom of the wells of a two-dimensional potential, given by a solid. Or, you know, we are going to ignore many, many things and just focus on those degrees of freedom that we believe are the relevant ones. We believe, we don't know for sure, but we believe so. And then the interaction may be much more complicated than the one we wrote, but still, our hope is that this minimal model Hamiltonian captures the essence of the phenomenon, or of the system that we want to describe. So it's simplified, but hopefully it's capturing the essence. And the second observation is that even though we've taken this very simple Hamiltonian, generically, we do not know how to solve it. Okay? Generically, we don't know how to answer what's the ground state of this Hamiltonian. By generically, I mean we have chosen this one because it will be useful later on. But you just put some spin degrees of freedom on a lattice. You design some interaction between the spins. And then when you try to find the ground state of this Hamiltonian, we just don't know how to do it. Generically, we do not know how to solve H, how to find the ground state, for instance. Very good. So there are many possible approaches. People have tried for many years to solve this type of problems. And we have number of possible approaches. Let me discuss a few. We could try with exact diagonalization. And then that means let's just take this Hamiltonian, let's build a big matrix with it. Out of it, and let's try to use matrix diagonalization standard techniques from some linear algebra package. The computer knows how to diagonalize matrices, so we'll just try that. And the problem with this approach is precisely what I was mentioning, that we have the dimension of the Hilbert space grows exponentially. And so the cost, problem with this approach is that the cost of this, the computational cost, is exponential in n. Okay? So that means that in practice, for instance, in practice, with very good computer, you can go up to, roughly speaking, 40 spins. And that's something you should not try in your laptop. You may be able to go to 20, or we'll see that we can go a bit more beyond 20, but not definitely not 40. But with a very good computer, we could try to get to 40. Okay? Now, we're interested in a many-body problem, where it's essential that we have many, many spins, and 40 is not going to be enough. Okay, so exact diagonalization techniques are not going to be enough. All right, second. So something else that we could try is perturbation theory. Okay. So perturbation theory assumes that we have an exact solution somewhere nearby, and that our Hamiltonian is obtained by adding some small perturbation to it. Or, well, we need to have some small parameter such that when this parameter is zero, we get back to the exact solution. And there is a lot of perturbative work being done. Perturbation theory is very useful. But of course, the problem is it fails for strongly interacting systems. And most of the systems we would be interested in are, or a large class of systems we might be interested in, are strongly interacting. All right, so what else can we do? I think a group, some of you, had a project last week using quantum Monte Carlo. So we can use sampling. We are dealing with a very large Hilbert space, exponentially large, but maybe we find a way of sampling over configurations of the spins so that we don't need to deal with all of them, but just some representative subset of them. And the problem with this approach is what's called sign problem, which basically means that it won't work for systems of fermions or frustrated antiferromagnets or a number, again, a large class of systems of interest are such that we cannot use Monte Carlo. Okay? We cannot just sample over configuration. So what else can we do? Then there is this class of variational approaches. And what we're going to do here is we're going to take the vector space that is of n spins, which is very large, too large. So remember, this had dimension 2 to the n, too large for us to be able to deal with large systems, large n. And we're going to identify some subspace, so or not even subspace, some submanifold. So the picture here is that we have this huge Hilbert space of dimension exponentially large. We cannot deal with the whole thing, but maybe we can identify some submanifold within there, smaller dimensional. So for instance, this could have dimension that goes as order n, linear in n instead of exponential, or maybe just polynomial in n. Okay, such that you know we are restricting our attention directly to a subset, to some region of the Hilbert space. We're not considering all the possible wave functions, but our hope is that the ground state that we're interested in is somewhere maybe near this one, this subset. And so we're going to use states within this submanifold to approximate the ground. Okay? Imagine the ground state is sitting here, and we're going to try within this region to look at the state that is closest to it. So within the region, maybe we'll identify some approximation to the ground state. And because we've chosen this subset of states to be small dimensional compared to the whole thing, maybe order n parameters will be enough to navigate this submanifold. Okay? And maybe then we will be able to find the state within the manifold that best approximates the ground state. And if this is a good approximation to the ground state, we might learn already the physics that we are after. Okay, so that was the motivation. And now let me tell you a bit more about what we're going to see. Over the next 3 weeks, and this is roughly divided into three parts. The first one is the many-body computational challenge. It's about what I just described today, I've just told you about. And so what we're going to see actually here is we're going to try. We know we are not going to succeed for large systems, but we're still going to look more carefully at exact diagonalization. So in this way, we'll go first to all the way to maybe 10 spins, and later I'll show you some trick that will allow us to go all the way to 20 spins. Okay? And then the next trick is to buy a very big computer and go to 40, but we won't try this here. And for this part of the course, there is one other trick that we're going to use. Then we're going to look at three fermions. Okay? And that's going to be a trick that we will use. We'll give up generality. We'll study some specific problems which are exactly solvable in some sense that we'll understand later. And this will allow us to go to n of several hundreds or thousands, let's say hundreds. And also, in some limits, we can also even take n equal to infinity. Okay? So we will be able to study, for particular example, systems that are very, very large. Good. And what we will learn, or what we will use in this pre-part, in this first part of the course, is going to be we're going to be using Julia. Julia is a programming language. We're going to be using Jupyter notebooks. That's just the way an environment, an interactive environment, in which we will use Julia. And then hopefully this will be fun, and this will be useful later on, because the type of things that you learn when you learn a new language, programming language, is something that you can use elsewhere in other problems as well. Then that's going to be the first part. The second part, what we will do is we will use exact diagonalization and free fermion formalism to study the structure of entanglement in many-body ground state. So what we're going to learn about is this area law. Okay? And that's the area law for entanglement entropy. We will see that that's a very important result that is useful in many research directions. It's having an impact in many research directions. And well, there will be more details, obviously. And then the third part is going to be about tensor network states. So tensor network states are, let me say three things about them. First, they are a variational approach. That means that we're going to be dealing with this trick I was describing before, where we give up generality. We're going to focus on some subclass of states in this huge, exponentially large many-body space. But hopefully that will be good enough for us to capture the essence of the ground states that we are going to represent. And so the ground state, now I'm just going to draw something here. And of course, during the third week, we will explain what that means. This is a drawing that represents a tensor network. It's a collection of small tensors connected together into a one-dimensional array. And the point of this type of approach is that it's efficient, meaning that if we have n sites, n spins, say, we will be using order n tensors. And each tensor will require some computational space. Manipulating it will take some computational time, but everything scales linearly in the number of spins. And so we'll be able to reach very large system sizes. Okay? And again, in some limit, we'll see that the cost exploiting translation invariance, we'll be able to see that the cost of these approaches becomes a constant independent of system size. And in this case, we'll be able to consider, again, infinite systems. Okay? And then I'm going to claim, just a claim, that they're unbiased. So first, let me tell you that when you deal with variational methods, the big danger of a variational method is that you're restricting your attention to just a subclass of states. And maybe those states, nobody in that class, in that region of states, nobody is similar to the ground state that you're trying to approximate. Maybe you want to study a ferromagnet, and all the variational parameters, or all the variational states that you have are anti-ferromagnets. Okay? So if the class, variational class that you are using to start with, does not contain any state that has the same physics as the ground state that you're trying to approximate, then you are in trouble. And the claim, which we will try to justify, is that tensor networks are unbiased in the sense that the same tensor network, say the one that I just drew before, is capable or can represent all, and now I'm going to keep using quotation marks here, types, all types of ground states. Okay? We have. So it's a claim that we will try to understand better. What I'm saying is that we are restricting ourselves to some subregion in the Hilbert space, but the claim is that it already contains all the ground states that we might be interested in. Question?
You mean all the ground states of local Hamiltonians?
It will be of local Hamiltonians that's containing that we are interested in. Indeed, there are many details there, and maybe it's a good idea to already write it explicitly, of ground states, of local Hamiltonians. But that's also not necessarily true, but to first approximation, that's correct. So the idea is that we've seen over the years that we are restricting our attention to a subset of states, which it's not such a big restriction, that they contain essentially all types of ground states that we are interested in. Very good. So then, what else do I want to say? So there are three parts. We'll start with part one. You can think of part one as being tools. We're learning some tools so that we can navigate a little bit in this huge Hilbert space, so that we can start studying the structure of ground states, and then finally understand what are tensor networks, why they work, and how they work. So you could think of this first part as tools, and then I would think of these two as the main goals. Understanding the area law for entanglement, and understanding tensor networks will be the main goals of the course. So why should you care about these things? As I said before, this part here is portable. It's portable knowledge. It's always good to learn a programming language. It's always good to know how to talk to a computer and let the computer do, or understand how to tell the computer what you want it to do. Portable knowledge means actually that if you decide to, you know, stay in physics, there are many places where you can use this knowledge. But if you decide instead to work in some company, you can also use that. Now, why should you care about entanglement in many body ground states? Well, so this is interdisciplinary research that has been taken place in the interface between condensed matter, quantum information, and computational physics. Okay. Over the last 10 years, it started in quantum information. People were wondering what entanglement is very useful in quantum information as a resource. It allows you to do teleportation. It allows you to do some sorts of quantum computation and so on. And so the question was, roughly speaking, 10, 15 years ago, what can we do with entanglement in the context of condensed matter? And then what we realized over the years is that you could study entanglement in condensed matter systems. And that's precisely what we're going to see during the second part. We're going to see that it's understanding entanglement in condensed matter systems is the key to a whole new class of computational tools. Okay, we will describe later on, but it's been the interplay between these three research directions what has led to these developments, which are now better and better established. And let me tell you then why you should care about tensor networks. So tensor networks started, as I just mentioned, as a way of simulating condensed matter systems, but the impact nowadays is much broader. So let me list this. So if you learn tensor networks, then if you learn what tensor networks are, then you're learning about tools that have an impact not only in condensed matter, as I said, to study, to efficiently simulate, so that would be a computational tool to efficiently simulate many body ground states, but also it has turned into a framework, a theoretical framework. So people use tensor networks to do theoretical studies about condensed matter states. For instance, a classification of all possible gap phases of quantum matter has been possible in part thanks to the tensor network. Formalism, not regarded as a computational tool, but actually as the natural way to express many body states. But the impact is also in statistical mechanics. So we thought that, well, what we're doing here is for ground states of quantum systems. It involves entanglement and so on. But it turns out that there is a dual description. There is some map between quantum systems, statistical mechanics systems. And so all the tools, or most of the tools that we've learned, automatically translated into tools for statistical mechanical systems. Okay, so if you want to compute some classical partition function, you can actually use the same tool. Okay, so in quantum chemistry, nowadays tensor networks are also being used for the same reason. This is purely computational. You just want to get some ground state of a molecule, and you can use some of these ideas there. But then there are a number of unexpected directions. So this would be just quantum systems in the end, this one at least. But then the same ideas have had impact in studies of error correction, both quantum and classical error correction, and image compression. So algorithms, classical algorithms to compress images, can also use ideas coming from tensor networks. And even machine learning. So tensor networks are currently studied to as a formalism that can be used also in the context of machine learning. And then it's going a bit crazy. So now quantum gravity decided that this is also an interesting idea to explore. And so in particular, there has been the suggestion that tensor networks realize are a lattice discretization of the ADS-CFT, a lattice realization of ADS-CFT, of the correspondent. I'm just giving you pointers. I'm not explaining what all these things are, but those of you who have heard about this can make the connection. And right. And so hopefully, by the end of the 3 weeks, you will have a better feel for what these implications are. Are there questions?
Can these techniques be used for looking at dynamics as well as just looking at the ground state?
So they were developed initially for ground states, but indeed you can use them in a less efficient way or less successful way also for dynamics. In 1+1 dimensions, so in the case of a spin chain, you can simulate time evolution. Mm-hmm. You can simulate thermal state as well with these techniques. You can do a number of things. When you try to go to 2 dimensions, then say a square lattice, then it's much harder. Then we're happy with getting the ground state correctly.
Okay. And is it just that you don't get any computational advantage?
You always get a computational advantage. You would not be able to even start if you didn't use this technique.
But it's still too,
we need to keep improving the techniques. This is a research area which is under development. We're not looking at the work of people 30 years ago. We're looking at things that are being done now, mm-hmm. including people in this room are already doing research in this direction. Very good. So any other question? It's your chance. Very good. So let's then get started. What we will do this afternoon, I think it's this afternoon, 2 p.m., we'll have the first iJulia session. That means we'll just get the laptops and we'll start. I'm not going to teach you iJulia. We'll just use it, and you are very smart, so you'll pick it up, hopefully. But the idea is, of course, we'll do that gradually. And the first application I wanted to, the first thing I want to study is the Ising model, precisely that Hamiltonian that I wrote there. Okay. And now I want to give you a little bit of theory around that. So we can call this lecture one. Maybe it's a bit late to call it like that. But that was the introduction, so let's start with the theory. So let's look at the Ising quantum spin chain. And the Hamiltonian is the one I wrote before. And now we're going to consider the case H equal to 1. This is the critical magnetic field. And so what happens for this value of the magnetic field is that we are at a quantum critical point. So quantum critical point, that's a critical point that occurs not due to some critical temperature. We're at zero temperature. So it's not due to thermal fluctuations, but due to quantum fluctuations. We really are at zero temperature, and the ground state itself displays some form of criticality. What that means, either you already know a little bit, or we'll see it when we directly try to analyze this Hamiltonian. But what I want to tell you now is that, as you may know, if we have spin chain in general, quantum spin chain, and we want to understand its behavior at low energy or long distance. Okay, so you have this system which is really just a lattice with degrees of freedom in it. We have some Hamiltonian, and now we would like to understand the long distance behavior of, say, the ground state or low energy excitation. It turns out that this can be often described by a quantum field theory. And I think you are now starting the quantum field theory 3 course with Jaume. Jaume Gomez starts today, I believe. And so you've gone through quantum field theory 1 and 2, and I don't need to tell you what the quantum field theory is. It turns out that at criticality, what we have is a conformal field theory, which is a special type of quantum field theory. And what we will do this afternoon and tomorrow is to use the quantum spin chain. We will be working with a small spin chain, and yet we'll already be able to extract information about the long distance low energy behavior. Okay? We'll be able to extract information about the conformal field theory, the CFT, that describes the low energy long-distance behavior of this spin system. So that would be a concrete application where we will be able to use exact diagonalization techniques to make progress. So what I need to tell you is exactly why is it possible, or how is it possible to extract information about the conformal field theory just by looking at the quantum a small quantum spin chain, and what type of information it is that we can extract. Okay, so maybe so I cannot tell you everything about CFTs, but I will tell you only two things. So CFT is the topic. I think quantum field theory 3, you will see CFTs. Okay, that's with Jaume Gomez. And those of you who are not planning to take that course, that's fine. What I will tell you now is all you need for this course. So one thing that you want to know about CFTs is that there are so-called scaling operators. And so this will be, we're going to be working in 1+1 dimensions. Okay. So that's one space dimension, that would be your spin chain. And then there is also a time direction. And you can imagine this is naturally parametrized using complex variables as the complex plane. And in this complex plane, we can put some field somewhere. I'm going to call these scaling operators phi alpha, where alpha is just a label that labels different scaling operators. And so in the complex plane, I'm going to tell you what the scaling operator is. If we put it at the origin of the complex plane, and then we apply two types of transformations, scale transformations and rotations. Then we will see a scaling operator is defined by how it transforms under scale transformations and rotation. So let's do this, scale transformation. We're going to send z to lambda z. We're just going to take the complex plane and zoom in or zoom out. Okay, that's a scale transformation. This is the scale factor. Okay, so a scaling operator is an operator that when we transform, change the scale in our system, it also just changes scale. okay, by a factor that depends on the scaling factor here, times something, and this something is going to be the scaling dimension. So this it's lambda to the delta, where delta is the scaling dimension of the field. So scaling operators are those that under change of scale, they are mapped into themselves times a factor that depends on their scaling dimension. This is what the scaling operator is, how it transforms under scale transformations. But we also want to understand how it transforms under rotations. So we saw scale transformation. Now we're going to look at another transformation, which is a rotation. So we, this, in this case, we send z to e to the I theta z, right? So we are in the complex plane, and we're going to rotate by some angle theta in the complex plane. So we are really leaving the origin of the complex plane where it is and just rotate around it. And the idea is that we're going to choose a scaling operator such that they also have a well-defined behavior under this transformation. So phi at the origin will be mapped into itself again, but times a phase. Okay, there is a phase now that depends on the angle of the rotation, times what we were going to call conformal spin. This is going to be conformal spin. Okay. So these are two properties that are going to be important to us, because these are the properties, both the scaling dimension and the conformal spin. These are the properties that we will see emerging from the spin chain. These are the properties that we will be able to extract from analyzing the spin chain. So we will be seeing examples of, for the Ising model, I can tell you already that, what happened here? So example, Ising model, which is the only one we care in for this afternoon and tomorrow. So for the Ising model, we have the Ising CFT. And then it's the Ising CFT is characterized by infinitely many scaling operators. And there are infinitely many, but I'm just going to characterize or to describe, announce the three most important ones, because the rest are related to those in some way. So there are three primary fields. Primary fields will be special types of scaling operators. There is one that is called identity. Okay. And this one has a scaling dimension. So under, under scale transformations, it transforms with a factor here, which is lambda to the zero, so no transformation whatsoever. And under rotations, it has conformal spin equal to zero. It doesn't transform under rotations either. We have another so-called primary field called spin, denoted by sigma. And this sigma has a scaling dimension, which is 1 over 8. Okay? So under change of scale, it transforms as lambda to the 1 over 8. And again, zero conformal spin. And then there is the so-called energy density. Okay. And it has scaling dimension epsilon equal to 1 and conformal spin 0. And these are just three of the scaling operators of the CFT attached to the Ising model. Okay. There are infinitely many. And I'm going to draw something here. So here I'm going to put scaling dimension versus conformal spin. And I'm just going to use colors. So it's going to be a scaling conformal spin 0, 1, 2, minus 1, minus 2. In the scaling dimension, we have the 0, 1, 2. And I'm just going to draw some lines here. You'll have this. This afternoon, we'll work this out with a computer. I'm going to draw another line here. OK. So the idea is that we can represent the scaling operators by their scaling dimension and conformal spin. And they will be, each scaling operator will be a dot in this diagram, right? This is the scaling dimension. This is the conformal spin. And if we do that, then we can see, if we take the identity, right, scaling dimension 0, conformal spin 0, it's going to be a point here. That's the identity. Okay. We look at the spin. It's going to be a scaling dimension 1/8. So I'm going to imagine that that's here. That's the spin. We look at the energy density, scaling dimension 1. Okay. So I've represented the three most important scaling operators, which are called primaries. And then it turns out that there are many more, and they are organized in some way. For instance, there is a guy here that's also important, and another one here. It's called the stress energy tensor. And this is what's called the holomorphic part and the anti-holomorphic part, and so on. There are many more dots I should be drawing. There's another one here, and so on. Okay. They are all these other guys are called descendants of the primaries. And why am I telling you all this? Well, it turns out that we'll be able to extract this picture or an approximation to this picture. From the spin chain. So why is that? And this is the last thing I want to tell you this morning. Well, so remember, scaling operators is the first thing I wanted to tell you about CFTs. So there is a second thing I want to tell you about CFTs. And it's that there is something called the operator state correspondence. That says that for every operator in the theory, for say every scaling operator in the theory, you have a state in the Hilbert space. Okay, and that's a big thing that I won't explain more than just by stating this. But I think, again, you'll see it in quantum field theory 3.
Two questions. Is this a bijection or just a function?
It's bijected. So
yeah.
In a CFT.
Okay. And it's only in CFTs that you have a correspondent.
I think the correspondent is much broader, but how precise it is, I don't know. And I asked exactly this question at the IT from Qubit workshop that we had in this summer, last summer. And so I asked the speaker who was presenting these things, is that, how does it work? And they explained it to me. So you can go back to the lectures there. And there's some anonymous voice asking the question. That was me, and there will be some answer. I didn't understand the answer. But that doesn't mean you cannot understand it. OK, so there is this correspondence. And then there is also the universal. A related fact is that there is a universal finite size scaling. And this is work of Cardi, John Cardi, in the 80s, I think 84. John was visiting us. He's one of the distinguished visiting researchers at Perimeter. He was here 2 weeks ago. And so what we learned there is that if we have spin chain, we're back to a spin chain now. And I'm going to draw the spins here. make it clear, it's a finite, it's finite, and we are going to use periodic boundary conditions, and we have n spins, right? So 1, 2, 3, all the way to n. Then, of course, we can have the Hamiltonian, say the Eisen-Hamiltonian that we've been talking about. We can have a translation operator that maps 1 into 2, 2 into 3, so we could rotate this spin chain. Okay? So translation operator T is going to implement a translation. We'll work with P and H this afternoon. And in particular, one can see that that Hamiltonian that we wrote up there in one dimension is invariant under translation. Okay? All the locations are equivalent. So if you shift by one all the spins, you get back the same Hamiltonian. And so what we're saying is that H and T commute. And therefore, we can simultaneously diagonalize the Hamiltonian and the translation operator. And if we do that, then we get some H, some eigenstate psi alpha. I'm starting to look at states, a basis of states of the theory, equal to E alpha psi alpha. And at the same time, T. So this is a basis. Psi alpha is a simultaneous eigenbasis of H and T. And here I'm going to write as eigenvalue of T, I A alpha. And to justify why I can write just a phase, remember that if you apply a translation by one side, and you do that again and again n times, then you get back to the identity. So if you shift by one side, you do it n times, you've done nothing. So that's the identity. Okay. And therefore, that means that T is a unitary operator. And its eigenvalues are going to be phases. Okay. So the result, the important result here, which I'm going to write there, is, and this, as I was saying, this is at what's called universal finitized scaling due to John Cardi in the 80s, is that E alpha is equal to some constant plus B, some other constant, times the scaling dimension minus some central charge term plus C alpha over n squared, or order. So let me first write this, but there is some relation. This is a state, psi of alpha. The energy of the state has to do with the scaling dimension, delta alpha, of some scaling operator of the CFT. And there is a similar relation for the momentum. It's equal to 2 pi over n, the size of the spin chain, times the scaling dimension, the conformal spin. Okay, so I insist. Well, this is, if you want, it would be very interesting to understand the results. These results can be understood, but at this point, I just want to state them because that's what we're going to be using. We can discuss them another time. How we get there? We can discuss that, but not now. So let me tell you what this means. Again, okay? It says, here, you have energy and momentum, right? Energy, momentum, from the lattice. So this is a lattice calculation. Okay. And here, we have the scaling dimension and the conformal spin from a CFT. So The CFT is the data in the CFT, these scaling dimensions and this conformal spin, this is universal information. It characterizes all phase transitions that go through that MCFT. Okay? When they tell you this idea of universality at the critical point, that many different critical points actually behave or are characterized by the same critical exponents, well, it turns out that the critical exponents are a function of this scaling dimension. Okay? So when you learn the scaling dimensions and this conformal spin, you suddenly learn what's the universality class to which this phase transition belongs. Okay? That's the type of very useful information to learn, because once you have this information, you know the universality class of that phase transition. On the left-hand side, instead, we just have some crappy calculation you did in your laptop for a given spin chain. So this is non-universal. But from it, you can really extract universal information. And of course, there are non-universal coefficients everywhere, and you have to find your way. You have to understand how to clean up these non-universal contributions. But the idea is that right there and right there, we have the type of information that will tell us what CFT describes our spin chain, okay, at criticality. And what I'm saying in the end is that up to these factors, this is essentially the energy, and this is essentially the momenta that you're going to extract. So you from plotting energy versus momentum, as a result of using exact diagonalization on your spin chain, you'll be able to come up with this picture. Okay? Question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering. So, okay, you have spins, which kind of suggests that there's some kind of rotation, no? Like, there's a link between momentum and rotation suddenly, or momentum and spin. Does that come from the fact that you're considering it, like, the periodic boundary conditions make you?
Okay, that's the part that I said that it's very interesting, and I'm happy to discuss at some point, but not now. So I just want to make the statement. I hope this statement is clear, because this afternoon we'll go after these guys, and tomorrow we'll extract those guys. Okay, that's the question I want to focus on. Now, the physical meaning of why do we call that spin comes from the two-dimensional picture, where we would have a rotation. But if we want to go there, and I guess time saved me from that, what you want to think of this is x plus iy, right? Now, if we really want to be working with 1 plus 1 space-time dimensions, we'll have to turn this into some Euclidean time. And so what we'll have is that this is Euclidean time, and this is still space. And what we call a rotation now is going to be a Lorentz boost. Okay, so the connection, we're going to call it spin, because that's the way everybody calls it. But this property would be how the particular operator behaves when we apply a Lorentz boost, not a rotation anymore. And then there is a reason why when you end up working with a circle, why that becomes the momentum. This is the type of thing I'm happy to discuss later on. More questions? OK, if there are no more questions, then I'll see you today at 2 p.m. I'm assuming that you have all iJulia installed in your laptop and it's running. And then also you've been able to download the first two notebooks, A1 and A2, from the wiki. I sent you an email yesterday with a new version of that. Okay? All right.